Let me begin by telling you another story. It's a story about the big-time failure bank robber, Charles Robertson. Strapped for cash one day, Robertson, just 19 years of age, went into Jefferson State Bank on a Wednesday afternoon and filled out a loan application. Apparently, he soon changed his mind and opted for a quicker plan to raise cash. And a couple of hours later, he came back with a gun, a bag and a note demanding money. He pushed the note towards the bank clerk over the counter, and she dutifully complied. He was bright, so he'd worked out that the police would very soon have been alerted, and more or less straight away, so he ran out the door. He was halfway to his car, and he realised he'd left the note back in the bank, and fearing that it could be used in evidence against him, he decided to go back and retrieve the note. So he ran back into the bank, snatched the note from the open-mouthed clerk and ran back to his car. Well, that was when he realised he'd left his car keys on the bank counter when he'd returned for the note. So total panic set in. He dashed into a gent's toilet in a nearby fast food restaurant. He dislodged some ceiling tiles and hid the money and his gun in the ceiling area. And creeping through the alleys, behind cars, behind bins, he finally reached his flat where his roommate, who knew nothing about the robbery, greeted him with the words, "Hey dude, I need my car." You guessed it, Robertson had borrowed the car for the robbery. But instead of owning up to what had happened, he dug his hole deeper by lying. "Your car was stolen, dude." Well, like a rabbit caught in the headlights, Robertson watched as his friend, his roommate, called the police to report his stolen vehicle. 20 minutes later, police arrived, spotted the car, and from the robbery, and word was on the police radio already that the robber had forgotten the car keys, and so they tried them, and they worked. Detectives went to the address of the person who'd reported the missing car, and of course, there was Robertson. He confessed. He was charged with the robbery and put into jail. No bail, no loan, no joking. Well, you have to admit, some days it is hard to do anything right. And Robertson is hardly unique. In our own ways, we've all acted like him. Maybe we've not taken money, but perhaps we've taken advantage or taken control. And then we've twisted and turned, trying to get ourselves out of a jam, only to make matters worse. And rather than simply owning up, admitting we're wrong, it was me, we engage in some stupid cover-up. And one of the most effective ways of doing that, actually, is by shifting the searchlight from ourselves on to others. We do it as children. "If only I can get Dad to really lose it with my brother, then I will get off scot-free." And so we play up our good points, and we play up other people's bad points. And that is just what we see happening in our story, Jesus' tale of two men who went to pray. Luke chapter 18. First, let's look at the story. And look at the purpose of the story. Spelled out for us there in verse 9. "He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt." Jesus is not in the entertainment business, telling stories for fun. They're hugely enjoyable. But he is in the business of exposing, telling stories to effect change in people by exposing our true character. So who does Jesus have his sights on in this story? We're told it's those who are confident in their own righteousness. And so as a result, they look down on everybody else. Now, when we come across the word righteousness, we automatically think that it's referring to a person's moral behaviour. It includes that, but I don't think that's what's primarily in mind here. Both in the Old and the New Testament, the word righteousness is primarily about having right relationships. Firstly, it's about being rightly related to God, being approved by Him. It's about acceptance. It's about approval. In fact, it was a term which was more or less interchangeable with the word salvation, which we all know. God saved, rescued people by putting them in a right relationship with Himself. Then secondly, it's about having right relationships with other people, loving them, loving and serving them in a way that is proper and sincere. So apparently there were people around Jesus who were convinced, confident, that they were approved of by God and so were right with Him and well thought of by others. They were part of the in crowd, in with God and in with the people that mattered in society. But did you notice the byproduct, the awful byproduct, actually, of having such a view of yourself? You treat others with contempt. You look down on others. After all, if you are on the pedestal that you have constructed, then you've got a lofty vantage point from which you can easily look down on others. But as we know, such a position can be rather precarious, and it only takes a little nudge before you're toppled and come crashing to the floor in one of those hundreds of YouTube videos of people foolishly balancing chairs on glass tables. And the interesting thing here is that it's Jesus who is about to do the nudging. Secondly, we've got the players in the story. Verse 10, the players. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. When we think of people going to church to pray, I guess we tend to think of somebody sneaking into a pew at the back of a church, getting down on a kneeler, closing their eyes, bowing their heads, clasping their hands, and silently, maybe lips moving, praying. But the picture here is actually very different. The scene is the temple, and both men are there at the same time. Chances are that they were at a daily service which took place twice each day, at dawn and then again at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was called the Service of Atoning Sacrifice. It began outside the sanctuary at the great high altar, with the sacrifice for the sins of the people being provided by the killing of a lamb, whose blood was then sprinkled on the altar. In the middle of the prayers, there'd be a blast on silver trumpets, the clanging of cymbals, and the reading of a psalm. And the priest, he would enter the outer part of the sanctuary and he'd offer incense. And then he'd disappear into the building while the worshippers would offer their private prayers to God. And this is probably the service to which these two men had gone up to. And you could not get a greater contrast, could you? On the one hand is this man you'd expect to be there, the religious leader. He's given over his whole life, basically, to God. No religious duty is too great for him. No devotion is too much of a burden for him. He's the pillar of the community. He's well respected, well loved. Surely that man's prayers will be heard. Why shouldn't they be? The other man is the drug pusher. He makes a living feeding off the misery of others. Yeah, okay, it's not literally a drug pusher in the story. But the first century equivalent. A man who collected taxes for the occupying power, the Romans. Such men added a hefty fee on top of their collection, and it was for themselves, of course, burdening an already overburdened and impoverished people. Scum, many would have called him. That sort of person wouldn't even know how to pray. So what is the point of him being here? That's pretty much what the point, what would have been going on through the minds of people as they heard Jesus telling this story. What are you doing here? You ever use that phrase? I'd encourage you not to use that phrase. If you meet somebody who is a bit out of context, particularly at church, never say, "What are you doing here?" It makes you feel so unwelcome. But it's, you know, what is he doing there? He doesn't belong. So they both pray. And thirdly, the two prayers in the story. Verse 11, first the prayer of the religious man. Verse 11, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of everything that I get." The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed. You see what he's doing? He's setting himself apart from the deplorables. After all, he is a Pharisee. And he doesn't want to religiously contaminate himself by accidentally brushing against someone who is spiritually dodgy. That would make him ceremonially unclean, and so compromise his righteousness. However, he does pray aloud, so that those over there can hear him, and maybe benefit from this spiritual man and his spiritual words. You ever been to one of those prayer meetings where someone rather badly conceals a sermon in their prayer, obviously aimed at someone in the room or a particular group in the room or maybe another church? Oh Lord, isn't it about time that some of us became more passionate about evangelism? But can what he really says really be called prayer? "I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get." In Jesus' day, there were basically three kinds of prayer that a good Jew would pray. Firstly, confession of sin. You'd expect that. Secondly, thanks. Thanksgiving for the goodness received from God. Thirdly, petition, requests for yourself and for others. Confession, thanks, requests. Now, with the very remote possibility of the second, thanks, it's difficult to see, really, how this man's prayer falls into any of these categories. There's no confession of sins, because apparently he feels no need to confess. There's nothing to confess, no sin to confess. There's certainly no offering of requests for others, especially the needy tax collector. And even though he begins by thanking God that he is not like other people, it's pretty clear who he thinks is responsible for what he is like himself. After all, look what he does. The written law of God only required fasting once a year. This religious giant does it twice a week. The Old Testament required the Jewish people to give a tenth of their grain, their oil, their wine to God. This man decides to tithe everything that he has. He gets his oldie shopping and he puts it on the table. "We'll have a tenth of that and a tenth of that." He went into fine detail. But do you see what his big problem is? It is the problem with the religious then and many of the religious now. It's legalism. Rule, book, religion. The real problem with the legalist is that he thinks he doesn't need God. You see, legalism is a search for innocence, not forgiveness. I must be all right, says the legalist. I've kept rules. I've kept many of the rules. In fact, I've added a few more myself for good measure, and I've gone beyond them. And so, at the end of the day, legalism is all about self-explaining self, justifying self, exalting self, asserting self. The legalist is quite literally self-obsessed. This so-called prayer is nothing but a lengthy self-advertisement. I thank you that I am not like other men. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of what I get. I. Now, there's a real problem when we come to this story. A danger that I fell into as I was thinking about it. We can so easily fall into the same trap which the Sunday school teacher fell into, who told this story of Jesus to her Sunday school class. Afterwards, she drew what she thought was the obvious moral lesson from Jesus' story. Now, children, she said, let's thank God that we are not like that proud Pharisee. The trouble is, it's so easy, isn't it, to slip into that mentality of the Pharisee without even realizing it. The self-justifying tendency lies deep, so deep within our hearts. Do we not feel even that little surfacing of pride when we think we've some theological insight that others haven't yet grasped? Is there that slight glow of self-congratulatory spirit when we discover that our Bible reading time is a little bit longer than somebody else's? Is there not some measure of ratcheting up of the pedestal on which we've placed ourselves when we hear that a fellow Christian, a brother, a sister, has come a cropper in some moral slippage? I don't know what your heart is like, but mine finds itself inclined precisely towards those sorts of things. And it is ugly. Let's turn to the other man, standing there on that day, the tax collector. Notice that he also stood apart from the crowd. He stood at a distance. Not because he was too good in his mind, but because he felt so bad. Verse 13. The accepted posture. In fact, let's read verse 13. The tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. The posture that you'd normally take in the temple for prayer was to look down, keep your arms crossed over your chest, like a servant before his master. But you see what this man does? He takes one of his fists and he beats his chest where his heart is located because he's so distraught. You see, in the Middle East, generally speaking, it was only the women who generally beat their chests, not the men. And in Luke, I think, possibly most of the Bible, the only other case of people beating their chests is where? Do you know? I'll tell you. You could probably guess. It's at the cross when the crowds, so disturbed at what was taking place, beat their chests at the end of the day, just after Jesus' death. Luke 24, verse 48. Now, just think about that for a minute. If it requires a scene as distressing as the bloodied crucifixion of Jesus to cause men and women to beat their chests. And imagine what utter turmoil the man in the story is going through. He's practically suicidal. He's so utterly filled with shame that he cannot even lift up his head towards heaven. And then just listen to his prayer. In most people's books, it's hardly a prayer at all. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. In fact, that is not quite right. What he actually says is, God, mercy seat me, the sinner. God, atone for me, the sinner. God, and a friend of mine says, every good sermon must always have this word in it. And I can honestly say I've never used this word in any times I've taught the Bible. But I'm going to use it now. God, propitiate me, the sinner. Oh, it's a comical word, obviously. Comedy words, write that one down. Good for a laugh. But propitiate. It means the turning away of God's anger, rightful anger, against sinners by a substitute death. So it's about atoning. So this word mercy, you know, we think mercy, it's a little bit cheap. Not at all. As he stands there alone, alienated, loathed, and self-loathing, he feels as if he's the only sinner in the world. And as far as he's concerned, all that matters is that there is God and there is him. And while he may have learned to cope with the sneers and venom of other people because of his occupation, the one thing he cannot cope with is the disapproval of God. He can bear anything else, but not the disapproval of God. That is the one relationship above all else that he wants restored. And that is the one relationship that he cannot restore. In this case, it is God who has been offended. And so the only one who can take steps to overcome the offense is God. And it's going to take a mighty act of divine proportions to get rid of the years of deceit and lies and bribery and cheating and pure godlessness and exploitation that has steadily corroded this man's soul like acid rain on a huge grand sandstone statue. And so he pleads this heartfelt prayer. God, be... Here it comes again, you're getting it twice. Be propitiated to me. Make some act of atonement to rid me of the defilement so that I can be restored to you, the God who made me and for whom I was made. But why does he think this is at all possible? Why does he think it's a prayer which God could, let alone would, answer? Well, remember where he is. It's interesting, Jesus doesn't say two men went to the synagogue to pray. They're in the temple. His eyes are on the very altar and the sacrifice of atonement, the sprinkling of the blood and the lamb. It's right there in front of him. It's called the mercy seat. Generally, we human beings are squeamish about blood. Anybody particularly a little bit squeamish in that? Yeah? If I keep mentioning blood, you watch. Maybe you mention it 3 or 4 times. There'll be somebody who will keel off their seat. Should we try it? We're squeamish about blood. I won't do it, don't worry. Well, God is squeamish about sin. He's repulsed by its stench and its stain. And the blood on the altar, there in front of the shame-filled tax collector symbolizes that repulsion as well as the cost involved in dealing with it. Blood speaks of death. In order for blood to be shed, an animal has to die. Sin demands death. Mercy is closer than you think. It is freely offered to you right now. Forgiveness is freely offered to you right now, this very moment. But that doesn't mean that there is no price which had to be paid. Don't think for a moment that it costs nothing. It is anything but cheap. Free, yes. Cheap, no. And this man, as he looks at the mercy seat, the altar, the place where the sacrifice is, the place where the blood has been sprinkled, he realizes, "Please, God," he cries, "let my sin be atoned for." That's the word mercy. "I don't minimize my offenses. I don't underestimate the penalty they deserve and which is coming my way if you don't do something about it. I see the blood. I know the cost. So please turn your anger away from me and be satisfied with the substitute put on the altar in my place today. Have mercy on me, the sinner." Now, only one of the two men was heard by God that day, and it was the man who said the least who received the most. Look at what Jesus says about the two pronouncements in the story. Verse 14, can you see? "I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. The one who is morally unrighteous is declared by God to be righteous." That is, he is put in a saving relationship with God himself. While the one who was morally righteous, streets ahead of you and me, is declared not to have a saving relationship with God, i.e., he's unrighteous. Not approved. Hasn't passed the scrutiny. You see, for Jesus, sin is primarily not about breaking the law, but about breaking a relationship. The religious Pharisee, with his exquisite record of moral achievements, is so far away from God that he might as well be in a different universe. And why? Because he has refused God's basis for friendship, which is mercy. Undeserved love. He'll have none of it. Even though God's mercy is closer than he thinks. He too is staring at the blood. He too is in front of the altar. He too can, he knows better than anybody what happens at the mercy seat. But he's so wrapped up in his own goodness that he's not particularly concerned with a personal relationship with God at all. When you're so good, who needs God? We probably wouldn't use those words. However, somebody this morning said, actually, I know somebody who said exactly those words. We probably wouldn't use those words, but when all has been said and done, maybe that's what it comes down to for you. When you're so good, who needs God? Church may be that filler for the religious part of your life. You enjoy the company. You like the singing. Can I say it was particularly good tonight. Songs were chosen, were fantastic, and it blessed my heart. Thank you. Maybe you enjoy the stuff we get up to, but when it comes to getting close to God, well, then you would prefer to keep God at arm's length. Is that it? Mercy is close, but it's for those who need it, and that's not really me. Is that what you say? Is that what you feel? Remember, if that's you, remember, what you choose in this world will be carried over into the next world, because refusing mercy, his mercy to you, will be the greatest mistake you've ever made. But look at the prayer God does here, and from which type of person it's prayed. It's the prayer of a broken and a desperate heart. It's the life which owns up that things are bad, and only God can put it right. It's the man or the woman whose eyes are drawn to an altar with blood on it. Not a human altar in a man-made temple, not animal blood, but it's a Roman gibbet, a Roman cross. It's human blood. It's the blood of God's Son, Jesus Christ, where he died paying for the wrong that you and I have done, atoning for our guilt and shame, removing God's anger that is rightfully directed at us, taking on himself our judgment. The blood of Jesus, sinner or saint, it makes no difference. That is the place we must all come to in order to experience what this blessed man experienced. And what was that? I tell you, this man went down to his house justified. The sweet words of not guilty. You are pardoned. You're free to go. Words that confer sonship on the guilty, shame-filled sinner. God declaring, "You're mine. I adopt you. You're my child." Don't be like the crook, Robertson, trying to cover up your guilt and making things worse, trying to deflect attention from yourself onto others like the Pharisee. Be like the tax collector. Ask for mercy now. It's closer than you think.